Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome, everyone, to Blog Talk Radio and the Voice of Change. I'm delighted to be with you this evening. My name is Sharon Ann Wyckoff and host of the program. This evening, we have Dr. Carrie Miller with us. She is an educational specialist, and she has a wonderful program to share with you. She's going to be talking about how movement really can increase your child's learning and seven unexpected ways to increase your child's ability to learn. The Voice of Change, Raising Our Children, Our Future, is a weekly program. We focus on nurturing the physical, emotional, social, mental, and spiritual development of today's children, as well as supporting the teachers and parents of these children. Featured guests will be those who are involved with children, nurturing them, allowing their unique spirit to soar. Our children are our future. At times, our guests will share their thoughts and their ideas and their insights about their own personal journey as a teacher of our children. Sometimes they'll talk about the journey of learning to live in the moment with children, working with children in new ways, and making conscious choices, and thus living by choice, not chance. These are changing times, and I believe the times are asking us to live in greater harmony with ourselves, with our children, as well as with the planet. And although there is much chaos taking place on the planet and in the lives of many, the potential for goodness, for healing, and for wholeness has never been greater. Today's children truly are unique. They are perceptive, they're intuitive, and sometimes wise beyond their years. We are all teachers and students, and yes, I believe that our children can be our greatest teachers. This is a time to be open to new ideas, healing ways, and change. And tonight's program is one of those special, special times with Dr. Carrie Miller. Dr. Miller is a board-certified educational therapist and director of Miller Educational Excellence, a therapy, an educational therapy in Los Angeles. She began her career almost 25 years ago as a special education resource teacher. She has worked with students in a vast array of capacities, including special education teacher and educational therapist. Dr. Miller has a PhD in educational psychology and mathematical statistics, a master's degree in learning disabilities, gifted education, and educational diagnosis, and a bachelor's degree in early childhood education and behavior disorders. She is very qualified, I say. It's just a delight to have her. She is in the Los Angeles area teaching special education, or she is a Los Angeles special education examiner for examiner.com. In her column, she publishes articles that provide parents with vital information about educating their special needs children. And she had her first radio show the other day, and it was a delight to listen to it. So she does work out of the Los Angeles area and has a practice there. So it is just a delight to have Dr. Carrie Miller with us today. Welcome to the program.
Well, thank you, Sharon. Thank you for that delightful introduction. That was so sweet of you. You were one of the reasons that my first Blog Talk radio show went so well. Thank you so much for calling in and asking your great questions.
Oh, it was delightful. It was just delightful. And I just think, you know, Dr. Miller, you have so much to offer families and children that it was just delightful to have you on this program. And I'm so glad that you've begun your monthly program. Before we begin, can you tell the listeners about it, your program, and when it's going to air next?
Oh, thank you. That's very sweet of you. It'll be July 27th. It's a Sunday at 3 p.m. It's usually the first Sunday of the month, but the first Sunday in July is July 4th.
Right.
So I decided to do it a week early. And it's going to be about helping your child succeed mathematically in the areas of mathematical skill development and also in conquering math anxiety and math phobia.
Oh, that is wonderful. That is absolutely fabulous. I will be traveling. I leave tomorrow for Northern California and Oregon, and so I will not be able to tune in. But it's wonderful because on Blog Talk Radio, we can hear the programs anytime.
I know, that's wonderful, isn't it? You can download the archive.
Exactly. It's just fabulous. So tell people how to get to your website, too.
Oh, yes. It's MillerEducationalExcellence.com.
Okay, and that is your regular website, right?
Yes, that's my business website. You'll be able to see the offerings that we have in educational therapy, the programs, and our staff biographies and testimonials. And you'll also be able to access my blog, which has articles of relevance on helping children in various ways, such as supporting their transition to college or reading comprehension strategies. There's lots of different strategies there.
Oh, that's fabulous. And then the website for your Blog Talk Radio show?
Oh, yes. It's a Special Kid School Talk. So it's blogtalkradio.com/Special Kid School Talk. One big word.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, we'll talk about that again toward the end so people can be sure and tune in and hear those programs. So today we are going to be talking about 7 unexpected ways to increase your child's learning. And that is just an exciting topic because, you know, with children who learn maybe a little differently, we need to be creative, don't you think? I know, I'm sure you do.
Absolutely.
But, yeah.
The traditional things are not working.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. Exactly. Uh-huh. Can you share with our listeners how you became interested in understanding these non-standard aspects of learning?
Oh, sure. You know, I was, as you were mentioning in my biography, I've been trained in a lot of diverse areas, and a lot of them are in special education.
Yes.
And that was just self-serving maybe, but that was just brilliant choices on my part, because the more I put together this understanding of human nature and human learning, the more empowered I became to be able to help people who have different kinds of problems. For example, some of the students I work with have attachment disorder. Some have ADHD. Some have autism spectrum disorder. Some have mathematics anxiety. I mean, to be able to deal with all the different types of things that learning or ways that learning can go wrong, I think became one of my greatest strengths, and it helped me actually to form my own life more strongly as well, because I was able to use the techniques that I learned on a kind of a clinical or practical level, but also I had a greater hope and expectation about my own life, I think, and I hope that kind of comes across to my students. I think that's one of the things that they sense about me, that I've overcome some obstacles. I think that kind of gives them some hope.
Yes, and you just, you know, the way you speak about your work, it's just been very exciting to me, because I haven't met you in person, but your energy and your enthusiasm to help children comes through.
Oh,
so
really?
I'm sure the children sense it.
Well, I hope so.
Because
actually, that is actually proven to be a key. It's one of those 7 unexpected things I'm going to talk about. It's the role that we have in inspiring others. That's absolutely demonstrated to be a significant factor in how much a person can progress under your mentorship.
So beautiful. And, you know, before we get into the actual program, I also just have to say, what a brilliant choice, really, on your part to have all that education, and how important for children, because, you know, when you take a child, if just one person sees that child, you don't know exactly what the challenge is. And with you having this diverse knowledge, I bet you can really zero in on what a child is, what that child needs.
You know, that's true, because we don't usually have our difficulties come in very neat, circumscribed, easily identifiable packages.
Exactly.
And particularly, we work a lot with students high school.
Mm-hmm.
And the challenges in high school are much more multidimensional, because students who have difficulty attending, or if they have difficulty with language,
mm-hmm.
that could show up as difficulty in writing an essay. That would naturally follow. But it could also come in the great amount of vocabulary that comes in the biology class, and so the ability to be able to work with students in different subjects is really helpful for the high school population.
Beautiful. So is there anything else that you want to share about, you know, what brought you to work with these children in these different ways?
You know, it's funny, I had a little background. My father was the chair of the special education department at James Madison University in Harrisonburg, Virginia. And he was advising me on a career path, and he said, if you go into special education, you'll always have a job. Well, I guess that's kind of true now with our recent layoffs. Maybe not as true as it's always been up until now.
Mm-hmm.
But what he was getting at was that people will have difficulty learning, and being able to help people who are having difficulty would be a great specialty, and he was certainly right about that. And I think that's kind of how I started off being more interested in the non-traditional side of
uh-huh.
education, because I also have certification in elementary education. But the more I got into the special education side, the more I saw that there was a greater potential to reach people that were, other people were having difficulty in reaching. And what a shame that was. And I set as my goal to become as good as I could be at reaching kids who were difficult to reach.
Oh, that's beautiful. That's really mm-hmm. beautiful. Do you want to talk something about the emotions and stress influence children and their learning situation, or should we go over the 7 unexpected ways first?
Oh, you know, it's probably a good idea just to mention what they are. Now, as I list them, some of them are not going to seem all that unexpected naturally, because one of them on the list is nutrition, and I think everybody has figured out that the better you eat, the better you do at anything, particularly
mm-hmm.
learning. And I don't think my first one's going to come as a super surprise that emotions have an effect on learning. But the things I'm going to say about it are probably not well known, and those are the things that I hope people will take from the talk, the stuff that they didn't realize, and that they can make some adjustments in the way they look at the way they relate to students or their children that can really help them learn, not just have a better relationship with their child, which is very key, but also can, surprisingly, it would help them learn more as well.
Yes, and I think sometimes, you know, parents and even maybe teachers don't realize that there are many factors in the learning process. So I think these 7 ways are just crucial for, you know, introducing people, if they haven't looked at them already, to know that there's things other than just the academic part of it.
Well, and that's for sure. And, you know, I did some research, obviously, to come to an understanding. And one of the books that I researched recently, I'd like to pass on to the listeners. It's called Teaching with the Brain in Mind.
Mm-hmm.
And the individual who wrote this book and several others on the same topic is Eric Jensen, J-E-N-S-E-N, Eric Jensen, Teaching with the Brain in Mind. And he cites quite a lot of research into the topics that we're going to be talking about today. So anyone who's interested in more information and interested in the actual research citations can grab his book off of Amazon and get a wealth of information about all of these areas. He's one of the most cited researchers in pulling it all together and applying it to the classroom. What does the research say, and how can a teacher use that information to have more successful outcomes in the classroom?
Excellent, just excellent. So these 7 areas, the first one is emotions and stress.
Good. The second one is motivation and inspiration,
mm-hmm.
not so surprising. The third one is social influences, which obviously everyone knows that social influences matter, but they don't usually think that social influences can make you smarter, but they can. And then movement, that's probably very surprising to people to understand mm-hmm. that movement can increase your ability to learn.
Yes.
And then there's a whole area on natural rhythms and hormones and other preferences such as that. There's a body of research to support how individual bodies respond to learning environments. And then nutrition, naturally, and we'll give you a few basics on that.
Uh-huh.
And then the physical environment itself plays a crucial role in how well someone learns.
Beautiful.
Well, I think some of those are pretty surprising.
Yes, yes, yes. Yes, they are different, but it's so important to look at the whole picture. So emotions and stress, how do the emotions and stress influence children's learning?
Well, we tend to think of stress as something that happens and that kind of depletes our ability to function adequately, and that is certainly true.
Uh-huh.
We often don't realize, however, that when we're happy and joyful, there is some certain chemicals being released that are not being released when we're stressed. And in fact, these chemicals, and one of which is dopamine, is the chemical that helps nervous, just a little background on how the brain is set up. The nerve cells inside the brain do not actually physically touch. They come very close to each other, but there's a gap in between. This gap's called a synapse. And if you're, one nerve cell is sending a message to the other nerve cell, it has to jump that gap. And the way it jumps that gap is the nerve cell has at the very end of it the ability to release a neurotransmitter, a chemical. That chemical goes out into the synapse between the two nerves, and the other nerve has receptors on the other side. They're kind of like catching the basketball. They're kind of waiting for that chemical to arrive. Now, one of those chemicals is dopamine. It helps nervous tissue transmit messages from one place to another. Obviously, if we can't do that, we can't learn, we can't grow, we can't even react, let alone begin to build a new platform from which to operate. So when you're happy, there's more dopamine in your brain. That's one of the reasons that for many years they've suggested that learning should be fun, and it should be, because the more learning is joyful, the more actual chemical support for learning is going to be present.
Oh, so that's interesting. So the joy and the excitement actually bring that neurotransmitter into play. And
that's exactly right.
Wonderful.
Now, the brain is going to release dopamine anytime it finds something pleasurable. So it's going to release dopamine when you get some chocolate ice cream or anything like that. But it's also going to release dopamine when you feel safe and secure, when you feel successful, and when you feel that people are recognizing and noticing your accomplishments in a positive way. So the lesson to be learned there, obviously, in a parenting or teaching context, is when you build successful experiences and experiences that a child finds valuable into your day, then more chemical support for learning is present, and whatever your child is doing at that moment is going to be more greatly learned. It's going to be learned more easily, and it's going to stick longer.
It makes that sense.
Absolutely. So that's why trying to craft an environment that's built on success and pleasant, let me be really, really clear. It's not why I'm advocating, let's just play with no direction in mind. That's not actually going to last for very long, because human beings are absolutely goal-seeking beings. They want to be achieving. They want to be successful. They don't want to just be having fun. They want to be succeeding and find the joy that that brings them. That's the fun that they're looking for.
Yes.
So when we craft an environment, an educational environment, that brings them a task that they can do, that they feel successful about doing, that's the kind of advice I'm giving. I'm not saying, okay, let's just have fun for fun's sake. I'm talking about putting successful experiences into play so that you have the full support of the chemical support of the body as well as the emotional support going on.
Yes.
Beautiful. Hope that was clear.
Just beautiful, beautifully put too. Just
well, you know what's so cool about dopamine? As I said, it helps the neurotransmitter. It's a neurotransmitter, so it helps
right.
the nervous system communicate its messages. And one of the places that it's really key is in the frontal lobes of the brain. Now, the frontal lobes are largely in charge of skills such as paying attention, recognizing and discriminating critical features, identifying differences between things, making decisions, having good judgment. All of those are absolutely crucial to successful learning. So the more we have dopamine in play, the more we're actually encouraging skills such as paying attention and telling the difference between very small distinctions between things and understanding what good judgment is from bad judgment, all of these things that we highly value as intelligent behavior.
Yes. Oh, just fascinating. And it just makes such perfect sense.
You know, on the flip side, though, when you're fearful and feeling threatened, the dopamine isn't flowing, and that produces a state where you have less ability to react, to make judgments, to tell the difference between things, to pay attention. It's a very bad situation. In fact, if it's a chronic threat or fear situation, it can dramatically impair your ability to remember, and over time, your nerve cells can kind of shrink and atrophy so that it's even more difficult for you to engage in intelligent behavior. It's really crucial if your child is having stress reactions to help them learn coping mechanisms, and if they actually require intervention either from you or from a professional, to get that intervention, because that stress has health issues, but it also has intellectual downsides, intellectual issues, and anyone who's under significant threat or fear, they're actually getting less smart over time.
It makes perfect sense, and I have seen this happen, and I never really understood the full why things were happening like this, but you've made it very clear here. Just fascinating.
Yeah, our conventional wisdom that I have, think about this. What are the things you're the best at? Are those the things that you hate? Of course not. Those are the things that you like. And we always thought, oh, well, we just like to do it, so we practice more. Well, yes, that's part of it. But because you like to do it, you have the chemical support of the learning mechanisms that make it more efficient for you to learn to do it.
Yes.
And it creates a great cycle, because the better you get at something, the more successful you feel, the more pleasurable you are. And the more pleasurable you feel, the more dopamine is released. And the more dopamine is released, the more quickly and efficiently you can learn to do whatever you're doing. It's a perfect cycle. Mm. It's set up for you to be driven or attracted towards the things you're good at, because it produces the sense of euphoria in your body on a chemical and emotional level that you're seeking. Oh, that was said actually very well, wasn't it?
Yes, perfect sense.
You know, sometimes I say things and I go, oh, wow, you know, because it takes me to a new reality in the way I approach kids. And
isn't that the truth?
Kind of just had an epiphany there in the way I said that.
Beautiful. Just beautiful. All of this I just think is so important, because it's giving parents, it's giving teachers tools, but behind it, it's giving them understanding. So
yes, that's right.
Something that, you know, they can really be aware of in order to make sure it's part of every learning session.
I'm glad you said understanding, because there's a great propensity of most of the population to not act unless there's a true understanding of why change is necessary. And that makes good sense, because to change a habit requires effort and it requires commitment. And it's only by understanding what the payoff is that we're willing to make those changes, because they're going to require effort. I'm glad you said the understanding piece there, because without understanding why being good at something and liking something are connected, a lot of people discount the fact that it's even real.
Mm.
Yeah, I've heard that so many times.
Beautiful, yes,
yeah.
So true.
Well, you know, our second area is so related to that. It's motivation and inspiration, and we've kind of alluded to that as we talked about how we crave the success experience and the euphoria that it gives us. And it's certainly true, because we're going to get a chemical boost. We're going to get a real high chemically whenever we're successful, and we really like that.
Of course.
Exactly. And the way we get that is having what I call a challenging task. Now, a challenging task is one that's not too hard and it's not too easy. If you think of, who is that, you know, with the Goldilocks. So she wanted one that was just right, okay?
Right.
Yeah, exactly. So when it's too hard, you can't do it. You provoke irritation and fear and threat, and so the dopamine stops, and so it gets even harder for you to do it. Bad, bad, that's bad. If it's too easy, then you're not going to get dopamine flowing either, because dopamine flows in response to pleasure. So when it's too easy, you don't feel like you've accomplished anything, so you don't generate any feeling of success. So there again, not so productive for you. So if your child, whether as a student of yours or as your child, you're a parent, is engaging in tasks that are too hard or too easy, they're not gaining intellectually, and they're certainly not gaining academically. So if you're a parent and your child is bringing home tasks that are too hard or are too easy, it's really important for you to coordinate with the teacher to get the task to be, quote-unquote, challenging, because that's when your child is going to be motivated and inspired chemically and socially to participate in those tasks. What often happens for kids with special learning needs, such as ADHD or autism, usually the tasks are not too easy. Usually the tasks are perceived by them as too hard, and they develop what's called learned helplessness, which is that chronic belief that you're too stupid to handle the task, that things are too hard for you. And in fact, it kind of permeates the way you look at your life, either in one circumscribed area, like just in reading, or in general, and you kind of shut down. You don't play full out. You don't try as hard, because why would you? Because it's not going to produce any good results for you. Mm-hmm. You don't pay as good attention. And the more you do that, the farther behind you fall, and the less chance you have to have a, quote-unquote, challenging task. And so the less chance you have for dopamine and other chemicals to be released to give you that pleasurable experience. And now you've got a real sour cycle going. And so anytime we can help kids pull out of their feelings of frustration or failure and direct their attention towards their successes, what we're doing is we're increasing their ability to neurochemically be successful students. Because the more they see themselves as successful and find pleasure in that, the more the neurotransmitters are going to flow and make them more available for learning, more able to pay attention, more able to see the critical differences between things, more able to make good choices about, okay, yeah, really, I really should pay attention now. And then their skills are going to increase. And so it's a good cycle that we've got going.
Oh, yes. Just beautifully put. Beautifully put. I have a question for you.
Yeah.
And I've been in classrooms volunteering sometimes throughout my life, and sometimes I notice people giving homework that there may be 5 pages or 6 pages for the week. Each one is totally unrelated to the other. It's just, you know, like they pulled them out of the hat. And it's not necessarily what they're working on that day. It's just, you know, busy work almost. And I know, you know, hearing what you've said here, it certainly isn't going to produce a excitement in most children. Any comments on homework and how you can make it more optimum for children?
Oh, that's a great question. You know, it's funny, in my research to talk today, I always like to put the icing on the cake, right, you know, and be as available when I speak about something. I came across someone who I bought the book, but it just hasn't arrived yet. And he claims that there's a lot of research that points to the fact that we should abolish homework. And I'm eager to read that book.
Yes.
And the reason I'm eager to read it, the reason I'm eager to read it is because I'm pro homework.
Oh, you are? Oh.
I am. So I want to know what his research evidence shows, because I want to be challenged in my thinking. Now, when you said totally disconnected, pulled them out of the hat, that's not the kind of homework I'm in favor of.
That's exactly what I would say. You're, Dr. Miller, you would not be giving that type of homework.
No.
Yeah, exactly.
I would suggest homework that was a natural outgrowth out of the inspiring, fun tasks of the day.
Exactly.
Now, that's good homework. And
right.
A lot of times kids don't even have that assigned. They just go do it.
Right.
because it's a logical progression for them of something they care about. Now, when we design a school like that, and all of our schools are like that, kids are eager to participate. They're eager to be there. They learn more. There's some schools like, I think we talked about this on one of the times that you and I spoke before. I think it's called the Sudbury School in Massachusetts.
Yes.
Or maybe Sudbury is the town. I don't remember. But the way they have it set up, kids come and there are no classes or strict rules.
Yeah.
When the student is ready to learn something, they approach someone to mentor them, and that's how they get the ball rolling. And so there's no structured curriculum. The child selects it. But what they found, because the child is selecting it, they actually care about it.
Exactly.
And that all of the kids that go to that school have profound learning, and they do a very nice job on standardized tests, and they get into good colleges because they've learned from the bottom up what it's like to be motivated to learn. They've learned how to take charge as opposed to react.
Exactly. I think that is just so true. And I have actually been in a Sudbury school.
Ooh.
And it was very interesting. You're just as you said, you know, the children were doing a variety of things. And if they were not motivated, they were allowed to be not motivated and doing just whatever. And I think there's a certain validity in that, because children sometimes need to get bored and need to have no interest in order to have that void saying, you know, what do I want to do? And then pull from within them what they do want to go into.
Absolutely brilliantly put. They have to pull from within them.
Yes.
We can't artificially determine someone's motivations. And the more we try to do that, the more we create kids who don't know how to self-motivate.
Yes.
All they can do is react or protect. How can we create a society from a basis of like that? We need people who can think, people who have goals, people who have passion.
And I was doing some motivational speaking on teaching and learning some years back through Toastmasters. One of my talks had the word educate in it, and I went to the dictionary to look, and the root word of educate is educe, E-D-U-C-E, which means to pull out.
Mm.
And I thought, oh my goodness, education is to pull out from the child. And, you know, you can do so much with that concept and then teach. But, you know, our school systems, for the most part, don't do that. They're just trying to, you know, put it all in.
For the most part, and kids who have special learning needs, I think schools in general, maybe not the private schools as much, but I think the public schools in general don't pull out of them very much. And the statistics certainly back that up in terms of academic progress, because I don't have my statistic in front of me, but something absolutely depressing, such as 20% or something of kids in special ed even go to college. It's something very dismal like that. Maybe it's a little higher.
Yeah.
And out of that group, only like 20% graduate. Now, that is a crime.
Oh, it is.
These are kids with intellect. What they don't have is skills, and we're not giving them a platform to develop those skills. And that brings me to my third area, the social influence. There's so much that we can pull out or educe from kids by our influence. And in fact, we can change the way their brain operates by contact with us. So anytime a kid is with someone who is focusing on creativity, who is focusing on not letting anything stand in their way, who's focusing on doing what they think is a good task for them, their creative purpose, they're drawing that same thing out of a child. But when they're with somebody, and very often that might be a classroom teacher who is just getting through the day, and I'm not criticizing teachers. Oh, my gosh, I started as a classroom teacher, and my husband is a classroom teacher. It is an extremely hard job because you have a diverse, you have lots of different kids with lots of different needs, but they're all in one big room, and you're being asked to make them sit down and pay attention, which, as in my next thing we're talking about, you're going to see that's futile. Okay.
Right.
Futile? Futile, not brutal. That's futile.
Right.
And on top of that, you're being asked to stop your instruction to test about every, 2 weeks. Mm-hmm. No wonder you feel like you're not doing an educator's job, a bringing out or a flowering of your charges, of your mentees, because you're not being put in a position where you can do that. One of my very, very famous, very favorite researchers is Lev Vygotsky. And you probably know of him. He coined the term zone of proximal development. Mm. And by that he means when a student and a teacher work together and that the activities they work on are just a teeny bit beyond what the pupil could do on their own without help, mm-hmm. that's when the mentorship relationship is truly productive. So whether
Say that one more time. That's beautiful.
Yes. So when a student works with either a slightly more able peer or with an adult or even an expert, but when the tasks they work on are just slightly beyond what the pupil could do on their own, that's the zone of proximal development. It means that in our shared perspective and our shared relationship, we are able to help that person move on to the next logical stage that they would not get to without that mentorship.
Oh, exactly, exactly.
So what it keeps, so when you're talking back about the homework that you just pulled off the shelf kind of a thing,
right. mm-hmm.
you can see why that homework would be in the zone of proximal development for somebody in that room,
yes.
but probably not for very many people in that room.
Right.
So let's be clear on zone of proximal development. If I put a worksheet down in front of me, which I'm not opposed to, by the way,
uh-huh.
I have a worksheet, pieces of paper are great, nothing wrong with that. And I ask a child to do that on their own for homework.
Uh-huh.
It better be something that they can, if they think about it and put their attention to it, get probably about 90% correct. That's the zone of proximal development.
Yes.
It's not
yeah.
so easy that it's a slam dunk piece of cake, and it's not so hard that it brings tears. That's not the zone of proximal development.
Exactly. Exactly.
Now, the zone of proximal development is a little higher when you're actually doing one-on-one work with a person because you can
mm-hmm.
gauge from their response what their thinking process is, and based on what they're thinking, you can challenge the next logical phase of development. But a piece of paper can't interact at that level of sophistication.
So true.
So I hope that made that really clear.
Oh,
so I think homework. Thank you. So I think homework, particularly worksheets, as we were talking about, I think they can be a platform that produces growth. But when they're generically applied, they're going to leave most of the people out.
And I bet that the book that you know you said you've ordered, it would be referring to that generic type homework.
I hope so, because I actually believe that continuing to practice in a meaningful way to you is crucial to your
yes.
efficient development.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. You know.
Yeah.
And I think your point is just so well taken.
Well,
how about going on to
a
movement, or do you have something else you'd like to share first?
There's one thing I wanted to share in that vein, and it kind of ties
sure.
back up to what we were talking about, the challenging factor, something being
yes.
too hard or too easy. It's really crucial that parents not do too much of their child's schoolwork. It's crucial for a couple of reasons. The first thing in this social influences area, if you do too much of the stuff for your child, the message your child receives is, I'm stupid, I must
exactly.
need to be bailed out.
Very true.
And that's
yeah.
the last message you want to send somebody. You want them to feel empowered. So if you're having to do too much of it, then it's not quote-unquote challenging. It's too hard, and you need to try to work with the teacher, because the more the child needs to get bailed out, the more the child becomes habituated to the fact
yes.
that they're always going to need to get bailed out.
Exactly. And these
yeah.
little things, some people don't realize how important they are. But if that homework is constantly way much more difficult than it should be and unrelated to what is in the class and they have to have help with it, you're absolutely right. That child is going to get into a cycle that is very difficult to get out of.
Once you stop trying because you need to get bailed out,
yes,
you don't develop the skills for coping and getting yourself out of trouble. And
right,
that trouble could be, oh, I just don't know how to study for this thing, or that trouble is, oh, I got that wrong. What should I have done differently?
Yes.
And so, believe it or not, why am I saying that? Everyone believes it. It takes decades to learn to be a good problem solver.
Yes.
And the more we shortcut that in childhood, the more we're forcing our 20, 30-year-old children to learn it. And, well, that's kind of late.
Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So true. And
well,
experience builds on the next one, you know, and so it's a cumulative effect.
That's right. That is absolutely right. Well, you mentioned movement. That's one of my favorite areas because I like to try to inculcate movement into our activities in the center as much as possible. And it's different depending on the age of the child. The younger the child, the more frequently they need to move. In fact, every couple of minutes when you're in kindergarten is not unrealistic. But adults can sit still for, well, none of us sit perfectly still, but, I mean, take a real shift in the way maybe we move something around. But we need to do that every 15 or 20 minutes. I'm the type that needs to get up every half hour and walk around or else I can't think anymore. So I'm going to give you some things that I learned from Eric Jensen about why that is.
Excellent.
One of the things that happens is when you sit, blood pools in, instead of going cycling, it kind of pools in your legs. And, of course, we need brain blood in our brains in order to be able to think. So we're diminishing our cognition whenever we sit for too long because our bodies are not geared for letting the blood pool in one place and still being efficient.
Makes perfect sense.
Yeah. So some things that movement creates, obviously, as you interact with the world by touching things, reaching out for them, writing something, you're sending messages to your brain and you're giving feedback constantly in this interaction between the physical environment, and that's where learning occurs. It's the feedback loop that develops that causes new neural connections to be made in the brain. So movement is absolutely essential for developing that nervous system foundation that creates learning for us.
Beautiful. What types of appropriate movement would you suggest for someone who is trying to work on some math or work on something in a, you know, at a desk? It could be in the classroom, it could be at home, it could be actually with you in your office. What type of movement do you suggest?
Well, the first most important thing I would try is a cross-lateral physical activity where one arm, for example, touches the other leg. So it's right side of the body meets contact with the left side of the body.
Mm-hmm.
Not necessarily contact, but that's a really good way. So actually, I had it in mind to give you a few really cool ones that I always find really
excellent.
Nice. Now, another thing you can do any of these movements to some upbeat music. And I would advise if you're trying to study, because that's one of the things that I'm going to talk about in my other ones in physical environments,
mm-hmm.
you don't want to have distracting stuff going on. And when kids listen to their favorite tunes on their iPod when they're studying, they're really listening to the favorite tune.
Mm-hmm.
What you should have is some upbeat music that keeps your spirit up and doesn't attract your attention so that you find yourself singing along with the words.
Oh, yes, yes. More instrumental.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you got some nice upbeat music going on in the background, making it easier to hear and to screen out anything that might be distracting you, then some cool cross-lateral activities are, I would probably stand up to do almost all of these,
mm-hmm.
Touch one hand to your opposite knee or one hand to your opposite heel and then alternate back and forth. Or if you're really supple, and I am not anymore, touch your elbow to your opposite knee or heel.
Oh, the elbow to the knee, too.
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, a little neurological explanation of why this is good. We're the left side of our body is controlled by the right side of the brain and vice versa. So anytime we get both sides of our brain involved. So when I touch my right hand to my left leg, I'm making both my right and left hemispheres come on, because the right hemisphere has to, the left hemisphere, let's make sure I'm really clear, my right hand, okay, it's being controlled by my left hemisphere. So to get my right hand to even do anything, my left hemisphere has to come on and take over. But when it touches my left leg, it sends a message to my right hemisphere about the experience of being touched.
Perfect.
So now I've got the right hemisphere and the left hemisphere both on and engaged at the same time.
Excellent.
And for any academic task to occur, this is essential. Because in general, and it's way too gross a generalization, but in general, the right side of the brain processes emotions and images.
Mm-hmm.
And the left side of the brain processes sequential elements such as language, math is a language as well, symbols put in a particular order.
Right.
So for virtually every academic task, we are sequencing language and integrating its meaning in terms of emotions or images or just a general gestalt, overall impression.
Yes.
Those overall impressions are controlled by the right hemisphere. So in order to have reading recognition, essentially a in-order language task,
yes,
correlate with reading comprehension, which is essentially a right hemisphere, get the meaning and emotion and overall picture of the thing task, we have to cross the corpus callosum, that division between the right and left hemispheres. And cross-lateral ability is essential in an academic task. So if you're having a student do homework that involves anything that's cross-lateral in nature, such as reading and writing, then cross-lateral movements generate the neurological platform to get the brain all warmed up and ready to do those tasks.
Just beautifully put.
Thank you.
So if you're going to have a student, for example, in your office, when you have a student come in for a session, do you usually begin with movement so that you get that type of thing going on? What's your protocol?
Yeah, that's a great question. I'm glad you brought that up. I've had several classes from a system called Brain Gym.
Yes.
And I believe you could go to braingym.com,
okay,
and investigate more about that. They have a four-movement sequence that they begin learning tasks with, and
mm-hmm,
it's called PACE. It stands for positive, active, clear, and energetic. And those movements, the third one in the sequence is a cross-lateral movement.
Okay.
So you can download a book. I wish I knew the name of the book off the top of my head, but I don't. But you can get a book that has all their movements, or you can get bookmarks that have the four PACE movements on them.
Oh, wonderful.
Yeah, so those are good tools to use to get the session going, or partway through the session when attention's starting to flag. Another thing I use a lot, I have a balance board. And you
do
can
you?
Probably, yeah, you can probably just buy one, but the one, I mean like a regular sports kind of store one,
uh-huh,
but the one I have came from a more like therapy type site.
Yes.
And a lot of kids like to stand on that when they're studying or do their math problems at the board, on my big whiteboard, as they stand on the balance board.
Oh, okay, so the balance board, I have one of them. It has a little knob on the bottom of it, and then it's just a round circle, and you have to put both feet on it.
Yes.
They are fabulous.
Yes. Now, you know why that helps you pay attention? Because the same centers of the brain that make you stable and maintain your balance are also the centers that maintain and have control over your attention.
Oh, this is a wonderful idea, Dr. Miller. Wonderful.
You know, I've had some of my kids with ADHD,
yes,
get one of those boards and actually do their best to stand on that and read, because they find that it's easier for them to pay attention. Of course, you couldn't, you know, do that for a very, very long time because your arms would eventually
right,
get tired. But taking like 5 minutes on the board and then five,
yes,
or 10 minutes sitting down and then go back to the board really
exactly
keeps them functioning.
Right.
Another one I really like is the karate cross crawl. Gosh, yes. It's hard to say. So the cross crawl is basically what I was explaining with the touching the left hand to the right knee kind of a thing.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
But I jazzed it up to make it a little more fun for kids. So I have them kick with their left hand while they do a karate chop with their right hand.
Now, what is this?
So, particularly for boys.
With the left foot?
Yeah, so particularly for boys. So
okay.
This is just a little more energetic, and it kind
of
brings out the macho in the boys, you know?
Right.
So I'm having, but they're not kicking anything, they're air kicking.
Right, exactly.
So they're air kicking with their left leg,
yes.
And they're air chopping with their right arm.
Oh, okay, sure, I can see how that can go. Right, uh-huh.
Yeah.
Oh, that is a great idea, too.
And the last one I'm going to mention is, I think, the kids' favorite. It's called Double Doodle. You get, I like whiteboard, but you can use a piece of paper and pens and pencils. You put one in each hand, and you're going to do a design at first is fine, but it's got to be a mirror image. They don't want to look exactly the same. You don't want to play tag. if you wrote your name, and my name's Carrie, so I'd write a straight line going down. And then when I did the K, the top of the K is, if you visualize in the middle of the K, on your right-hand side, it's going to go up to your right. Well, on my left-hand side, it's going to go up to my left.
You're going to do
a mirror image.
Like a mirror image?
Exactly.
Oh, my goodness. And they do it with both hands at the same time?
Exactly. And what's good about that is, of course, you got both hands working, so both hemispheres are working. But then I also make them, after they do a design, just to have some fun, I make them do something that requires a lot more attention, like writing in English or even writing in Greek. I've had them write their names in Greek. They like that. Well, anyway, what that does is you have to pay a lot more close attention to what you're doing, so you're looking back and forth from side to side. So now I've got the right eye looking over in the left visual field, which means I've got the visual centers doing the cross-lateral thing, and they're both, now all my visual centers are instantiating to come up to speed to take care of this task.
Oh, my goodness. I could ask you to repeat that, but you know what? I'll go back and listen to the tape. That's brilliant.
Okay.
That's brilliant.
Okay. Yeah, the double doodle's fabulous. The double doodle's fabulous.
Oh, what a great idea.
I'm looking at
you
my
know,
time.
Pardon me?
And I think we can make it. We're doing great.
Well, I was just going to think. I'm looking at the time, too. If you want to talk, I can extend the program a little bit. Do you want to do that, or do you want to try and finish the last two in the next, or three in the next 4 minutes?
Yeah, four? Is that 4 minutes?
4 minutes, yes. I need a few minutes at the end.
Oh, I see. What would you like to do? I'm fine to go another couple, 10 minutes or something if you want
okay,
to.
Okay, I think we should because this is just so rich.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going
sure.
to let you go on and talk with the number five and if you've finished with movement.
Okay.
And then when you get talking, I'm going to go into the board, and I don't do very well with my attention in both places, so I'm just going to let you talk for a moment.
Oh, I know what you mean about all that multitasking stuff. Whoa.
Yes. Oh, but
okay,
that section on the movement has just been fascinating.
Oh, thanks.
And so important for children.
Well, go ahead and do your coordination
okay,
there.
Okay, I will do that for my. I will do that on the computer, and then you can just go on and continue talking with. The next section.
Okay. Well, you know what? Before I leave movement, there's one thing I didn't mention for little kids that I like to do at the center. When we're having a little child work, and of course we work after school, so a kid has already had a full day of school, and sometimes they come, they're tired, so they need to be rejuvenated in the experience for a couple of reasons. They need to find learning experiences rejuvenating, and very often in classrooms they're not. And so that's our goal, to make sure that when you come to work with us that you leave feeling a lot better than when you came in, and also a little bit more knowledgeable and smarter, too. So one thing we do for little kids, we let them move every couple of minutes if they're very young, and even through elementary school, we let them move every 5 minutes or so. And one way I've found to be very productive to build movement into a session that I haven't mentioned yet
mm-hmm.
is suppose that they wanted to put together a jigsaw puzzle, and we had maybe a eight-piece puzzle or something like that,
mm-hmm.
and we were working on spelling words. So I'd have them practice one or two spelling words in a particular manner, and it would probably be something they enjoyed doing too. You can listen to my last show, Blog Talk Show, and I gave a lot of good examples on fun ways to practice spelling. It was my first show on, that would have been June 7 or 3 or something like that.
Sunday, wasn't it?
Yes, it was June 6th.
So that was June 6th.
Yes, and it had a lot of fun ways to practice spelling. So if your listeners want to get that, they can get some cool ideas there.
Excellent.
But after doing a couple of spelling words, then I'd have I would have hidden the puzzle pieces around the center someplace.
Oh, so, how fun.
Yes, it is. So I would have them go out, and when they find a puzzle piece, so they're getting some movement, so they're getting the blood unpooled out of their legs, so they're able to think again. And they're also having a really good time because it's something they want to do. And they're also searching around for something, so they're having to look all over and bend and look back and forth. So all parts of their brain are on in many ways. They find a puzzle piece, they bring it back. When they've got all the pieces, then they can put the puzzle together.
Oh, that is an excellent job. Excellent.
You can work that into homework time, too. Parents can do that.
Exactly.
Now, we all know that we all have a best time of day. We function better at certain times of day. And even within that, some tasks we do better at certain times of day. Well, this is the whole area of the body's natural rhythms and preferences.
Mm-hmm.
But it goes even farther than that, because the human mind isn't really designed for focused concentration. It is designed to be like a cheetah. It is designed for short bursts of focused attention. It is not designed for long bursts of attention. And if we keep trying to get our nervous system to do something it's just not set up to do, we're just destined to be frustrated. So we need to have lots of changes of pace. So one thing we do, we get up and move around. Another thing you can do in a home environment, if you have posters on the wall or the screensaver in your computer, change that every now and then. In other words, it's this differences that get the brain to become alert and to feel that that's another thing that the brain responds to is novelty. So anything that you can do to stimulate the novel sensation in your brain gets your brain to pay attention. So when you get it to pay attention, now's the time to focus that attention on something academic. So in our double doodles, I always have the kids pick two different colors because that is more visually processing for the brain. The brain finds two colors more novel than one.
Yes, of course. Yeah. Oh, that's an excellent idea.
So any good productive changes you can make like that, working in a different colored pencil or anything that you can do that would make it more novel. And find your best time of day for your particular subject. Some people are much more alert. I was working with a woman today, actually I work with adults as well, and she's about to take the MCAT. That's a medical examination that gets you into medical school.
Oh, okay.
And she has the option to take it either at 8 in the morning or 1 in the afternoon. Now, me, I would be taking it at 1 in the afternoon because I'm a confirmed vampire. But she doesn't function well in the afternoon. She wants to take it at 8 in the morning because she wants to optimize her chance to do well on the exam.
Sure.
Same thing is true with kids. Even though they're young, they already have their natural body rhythms. And one thing that's often true for adolescents is they are definitely more like me. They are definitely not the early birds. More adolescents are the night owls.
Mm-hmm.
So when they had a school movement in New Mexico, where I came from, to start school an hour or so later for high school, it was very well received, and the kids did better because they're much more alert later in the day.
Wonderful.
Yeah.
What a wonderful when someone makes a decision like that and it really helps the children, that's just fantastic.
That's right. Our next one is nutrition, and that's certainly not very surprising. But one thing that Americans might not realize is that most children are improperly nourished. They are not well nourished anymore. We're very busy, and I'm busy too, and I'm as guilty of poor nutrition as anybody, I suppose. But I work at it. That's one of the things that I have to work at, because I have some I have a sensitivity to wheat, and to avoid wheat is a dramatic challenge, I'll tell you. Yeah, so working around that is an encompassing kind of thing. But the thing to, obviously, we should avoid sugar as much as possible. And I want to give you a few of the facts behind some of these good things so that people really realize where the information or where the advice is coming from.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the first thing that's absolutely crucial to be a good learner and a good thinker is enough water. Because the body is, whatever, 80-some percent water, and your brain is even more than that, I believe. In order for a nervous impulse to go from one place to another, it has to have an aqueous or water environment. So if you're poorly hydrated, your brain is functioning poorly. So you need to encourage your child to stay hydrated and to drink 8 to 12 glasses of water every day. And you need to be hydrated at frequent intervals. So another thing we have in our center is we ask children to have a little bit of water before they start their session, because we want to make sure that we have full availability to them of the ability to think whenever possible.
Sure.
Now, we need to reduce sugar. And the reason, there's many reasons, I'm sure, but a couple that I'm aware of, is that in order to think very well, we need to be alert. And we need to produce epinephrine and norepinephrine in order to do these. These chemicals increase the ability of our brains to metabolize glucose, and glucose is the fuel for the brain. So if we don't have enough epinephrine and norepinephrine, our brains aren't getting the right amount of energy to function. Now, one thing you'll notice, particularly with kids who have ADD or ADHD, is they don't produce enough of those epinephrine and norepinephrine chemicals to keep them, their brains, stimulated. So their brains are actually kind of in a sleepy kind of state. And that's why kids with ADHD are constantly moving, because that movement is a way to stimulate themselves so that their brains will start, so that they won't fall asleep.
Oh, that is so interesting.
So what we're doing in a classroom when we say to a child, don't move, is what we're doing is we're prohibiting them from using a natural body response to a sleepy kind of state to rejuvenate. It's absolutely counterproductive to say to someone, sit still, in every way. So for our kids in our center, we realize that a lot of the students with whom we work have ADHD, so we know that we need to let them keep moving, but at the same time, we need to have ways for them to be able to focus on what we're doing here at the time.
Yeah.
So some things that can help are doodling. You often see kids doodling in class, or playing with their earrings, or braiding their hair, or anything, tapping their feet, any of these things. That what they're really doing is they're trying to stay with you. They're trying to stay alert.
But as a teacher, I can tell you that it really is interesting when you have 20 children doing 20 different ways of staying awake and to try and teach.
Exactly why you need to build the movement into the lesson plan.
Yes.
So every few minutes, depending on the age of your child, I would do it every 5 or 10, and in the afternoon I would be 5 after lunch. For little bitty kids, my high school, maybe every 10 or 15 minutes, I would have a particular activity built in where you had to do something like stand up. Oh, I love this activity. So stand up, get a partner. I'm going to think of my favorite food, and my partner's going to think of their favorite food. And I'm going to take my right hand, and we're going to face each other. I'm going to take my right hand, and I'm going to slap their right hand, which means it's cross-lateral, so that means both sides of my brain are coming on now, because I'm watching my right hand go over to your left side.
Yes, yes.
And I'm going to spell the first two letters of my word, so P-I.
Oh.
And then I'm going to wait, and you're going to spell the first two letters of your favorite food, and yours might be Y-O. And then I'm going to continue with my word, and then you're going to continue with your word. And after we're done with our word, it's very fun. And then we have to figure out what we just spelled. So all kinds of energizing stuff.
Oh,
and it's also socially
wonderful.
Interactive, too.
Yes.
So you need to build movement in, so that's going to reduce the need to braid your hair and do 10,000 other things.
Exactly. And you're going to be able to do it in the timing that you want it, so the children are going to be satisfied and able to move on. Brilliant.
That's right. And if you can build it into a content, too. So like if you're teaching math, then build something mathematical into that interlude. Then it's even better.
Right, yeah.
Now, we need minerals. We need calcium. I'm reading a book here by Dr. Frank Lawless, Lawlis, and it's called The ADD Answer, How to Help Your Child Now. And actually, Dr. Phil McGraw wrote the foreword for this book.
Okay.
And he's talking about calcium as being the quote-unquote traffic cop in the nerve cells, directing the uptake and release of neurotransmitters. So those neurotransmitters are helping the nervous system, the cells in the brain, transfer information from one place to another. So calcium is essential for those chemicals to be able to do their job. So we need calcium. We need magnesium. Those two act as partners in helping our brains function more efficiently. So those are two things that we absolutely have to have. And we've got to have vitamin C because it's essential for producing norepinephrine, dopamine, and serotonin, which are all active when we're thinking, so to speak.
Excellent.
Okay, well, basically,
wonderful information.
We want to stay away from sugar foods as much as possible. We want to have whole grains and less processed stuff because there's more minerals and vitamins in those foods. And we want to have vegetables and fruits and omega-3 fatty acids. And if we're not getting them from our food, we should be supplementing. So if your children don't have a stellar diet, and I don't think anyone in America anymore has a stellar diet, good organic supplementation is vital.
Yes, I've heard that the omega-3s are just, or the fatty acids are just essential for that.
Exactly. And water.
Yes.
Okay, now our last area is physical environments. And believe it or not, the physical environment can erode our ability to function in such a dramatic way that it ranks being on this list. So things such as seating and lighting and the ambient sound have a great impact on whether a child can learn. First thing I realized when I was doing my research was that the chair can make or break your experience. I hadn't really realized that. The chair that you sit in.
The chair.
Actually, the chair's properties are crucial. You need a chair where your shoulders can be back, because if they're not, then you don't have so when your shoulders are back, your chest opens up and you're breathing, and that breathing is bringing the oxygen in along with oxygen and glucose. Those are what the brain is feeding on. So you have to be able to take deep breaths. So you can't be slouched over because you're not getting adequate oxygen. You're not getting enough blood supply to your brain that way.
Mm-hmm.
You also, your feet have to touch the floor. A couple of reasons for that. And comfortably touch the floor, not just barely on tiptoes touch the floor. Because the chair should support your legs rather than cut into it. If your chair is cutting into your legs, then it's shutting off the circulation of your blood, and you're getting much less blood up into your brain to think.
Yes.
Light is another thing that has a great influence on us. One of the nutrients we need in order to think is vitamin D. And there's vitamin D is essential for making melatonin, and that regulates your body rhythm. And vitamin D is produced whenever we are exposed to natural sunlight.
Mm.
So we need to go, so our kids need to be outside, and we do too. We need to be outside in the sun at least part of the time during the day, and we need to reduce the artificial light and get more natural light, because that's what's going to build the vitamin D stores in our body that are essential for our functioning. And the last area is sound, the auditory environment. Our brains actually are processing about 20,000 bits of auditory information every second. That's astonishing.
Astonishing.
We are information processing miracles, okay? Now, in order to think, though, we can't have sound that is unpleasant and is producing stress, because that's going to reduce the neurotransmitters available to us. So we need to reduce distracting noise. That's why your child shouldn't be listening to their iPod and their favorite songs, because they're going to be distracted by that rather than being in a zone of great attention. We also shouldn't have latent washing machines in the background or artificial lights that are going and stuff like that, because that cuts away our ability to focus. And now our auditory system is being overloaded and challenged to do that, as opposed to giving our attention to learning what we're trying to learn. So one thing we always do in our center is we always have some quote-unquote white noise on. We always have some music, upbeat music, playing during the session, but it's never singing. It's always instrumental, but it's always upbeat and pleasant and happy, and we keep that going the whole time we're working with kids. Because here's some other good ways. You could do a desktop waterfall. I love that one.
Really?
Or a fish tank, something where you can kind of listen to a nice, soothing kind of sound.
Oh, the water sounds are so soothing for me.
I love my waterfall.
Oh, I can imagine. I can imagine. What is your opinion of fluorescent lights in the classrooms?
Nice question. There is a proportion of the population, I don't remember the statistic off the top of my head, that is adversely affected by fluorescent lights to the point where they can't concentrate, and it's very detrimental to them. In fact, they feel physical pain in terms of the fluorescent light. So in our center, I had them install warm fluorescent lights, which is a step up from that. Even then, I have some of the parents who come into the center, they want to turn half the lights off because they find it annoying. And so there's a lot of kids sitting in that same predicament. So for kids, I would, a child who's expressing that kind of difficulty in focusing with the artificial light, I would get them next to the window so that they can be relying more on natural light.
Oh, that makes sense, sure.
To stimulate them. And if it's impossible, there is the Erlen Center. I believe it's IRLEN or it's ERLEN.
Okay.
The Erlen Center does work in diagnosing and treating problems such as that. Kids who have difficulty focusing because of some visual mechanism such as that. I'm not maybe making that very clear. One of the things that Erlen Institute prescribes is colored lenses that help change the light color that's coming into the brain so that the brain isn't finding a stressful reaction in the environment.
Oh, how interesting.
And that is actually in the near Los Angeles area, somewhere near us. So if listeners want to go online and find the Erlen Institute, if they're having any difficulty that they think may be attributed to maybe it's eye strain, they might deal with that, or fluorescent lights. That's certainly a place to start.
Well, wonderful.
That's what I have for today.
Oh, Dr. Miller, I just really thank you for sharing your expertise with us. There are so many areas and suggestions that you've made that are really going to be helpful for parents and for educators. So thank you so very much.
Oh, you're welcome, Sherry. I so enjoyed talking with you, as always. You're such a lovely person.
Oh,
thanks for all the work you do.
Thank you. It's always a pleasure to have you. So let's tell our listeners one more time about your website.
It's MillerEducationalExcellence.com.
Excellent. And then the way they can go to your website at Blog Talk Radio?
Oh, right. It's blogtalkradio.com. /specialkidschooltalk.
Excellent. And your next program is going to be on June 27th, a Sunday, 3 o'clock in the afternoon Pacific time?
Yes, that's right. And please call in. We take questions. I love questions. And I also do special segments such as the success story of the month for special needs kids.
Yes.
And also from your child's perspective, what your special needs child wishes you knew.
Wonderful, wonderful. Mm-hmm. Well, this
has
been an absolute delight, and I hope people will really tune into your program and call in and take advantage of, you know, you and your expertise and really ask those questions that they need the professional guidance for.
Oh,
and,
thank you very much.
Oh, my pleasure, my pleasure. And I look forward to more in the future.
Oh, thank you, hon, and thanks again for having me. I enjoyed it so much, as always.
Oh, thank you so much for being here. We'll talk to you another time.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay.
Bye.
Bye now. That was Dr. Carrie Miller, and again, her website is, I have it here, Miller. Oh, my goodness, my screen just blanked out here. Actually, I don't have it right here. Yes, I do. It is MillerEducationalExcellence.com. Again, www.MillerEducationalExcellence.com. I want to let you know about a few things that are upcoming. I have begun a program for young people, even actually children too, from the ages of 5 up to 19 to call in. It is at blogtalkradio.com/youthspeak, and that is going to be held periodically. The next program is going to be July 12th. That's a Saturday morning, 10 o'clock Pacific time. And if you have a child who would like to call in and share a poem that they've either written themselves or their favorite poem, they can do that. Or just tell me what they is of interest to them. And I'm particularly interested in things that children are doing to really help the planet in some way. So that is blogtalkradio.com/youthspeak. And the next program, July 12th, Saturday at 10 a.m. And also, I've started some classes for children to learn how to write poems. I've been teaching poetry in the classroom here for a while now, and I just love doing it. So if your child would like to write some poetry or learn and to develop the radio voice or her radio voice for radio, they can contact me. And I have a website. It's TLC Classes for Kids. Again, that's www.tlcclassesforkids.com. And this class for children is going to be actually a teleclass, so they can call in. And I want to let you know that this is going to be my last program on Thursdays for a while. I'm taking the summer off. If we have a real special that comes along, I will definitely let you know. But for right now, I am going to be taking the summer off from the Voice of Change. And I will be back in the fall for sure. So thank you for listening. We have a wonderful selection of programs at the Blog Talk Radio site, blogtalkradio.com/Sharon-Ann. That's SHARON-ANNE. And Dr. Miller has been on 2 times previously, so you can just do a search for Dr. Carrie Miller. That's K-A-R-I. And then Miller, M-I-L-L-E-R, and listen to all of her programs, as well as many other programs on the site. So thanks for listening. Have a wonderful summer, and I will be back in fall, if not before. Bye for now.